The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. This month's subject is For Your Eyes Only. It's a new James Bond novel, but of course not written by Ian Fleming. William Boyd, a distinguished novelist in his own right, was commissioned to bring 007 back to life, and the resulting novel, Solo, has disarmed even the most obsessive of Fleming fans. In the stylish Faraday Lecture Theatre of the Royal Institution, scene of many a dramatic presentation in centuries past, he read the opening chapter to host John Mullen.
I'm going to read just a little bit from the opening chapter to give you a flavour of my take on Bond and my spin on Bond. And I'm sure it'll give rise to lots of speculation and questions with a bit of luck. Chapter 1, In Dreams Begin Responsibilities. James Bond was dreaming. Curiously, he knew at once where and when the dream was taking place. It was in the war, and he was very young, and was walking along a sunken country lane in Normandy, a dirt track between dense blackthorn hedges. In his dream, Bond turned a corner and saw, in a shallow ditch at the side of the muddy roadway, the sodden bodies of three dead British paratroopers, clumped together. In some shock, he paused instinctively to look at them. They seemed in their huddled, inert mass to be part of the earth in a strange way, some vegetable growth germinating there rather than human beings. But an angry shout from the rear told him to keep moving. Bond woke and sat up in bed, troubled and disturbed by the dream and its intense vividness and eerie precision. His heart was beating palpably, as if he were still walking down that muddy track past the dead paratroopers heading for his objective. He thought about the moment. He could identify it exactly. It had been the late morning of 7th of June 1944, a day after the invasion of France, D-Day plus one. Why was he dreaming about the war? Bond rarely ventured into the haunted forest of memory that made up his recollections of that time. He ran his hands through his hair and swallowed, feeling his throat sore, sharp. Too much alcohol last night? He reached over for the glass of water on his bedside table and drank some mouthfuls. He lay back and further considered the events of 7th of June 1944. Bond smiled grimly to himself and slid out of bed and walked naked into the ensuite bathroom. The Dorchester had the most powerful showers in London, and as Bond stood under the needle jets, feeling his skin respond to the almost painful pressure, he sensed the traumatic memories of that day in 1944 begin to retreat slowly, washed away. He turned the tap to cold for the last 20 seconds of his shower and began to contemplate breakfast. Should he have it in his room or go downstairs? Downstairs, he thought, everything will be fresher. He shaved and dressed in a dark blue worsted suit with a pale blue shirt and a black silk knitted tie. As he tightened the knot at his throat, more details of his dream began to return to him unbidden. He'd been 19 years old, a lieutenant in the special branch of the Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve, attached as an observer to Broad Force, part of 30 Assault Unit, an elite commando charged specifically with the task of capturing enemy secrets, documents, files and encoding devices, all the legitimate plunder available in the aftermath of battle. Bond was in fact looking for a new variation of a Wehrmacht cipher machine, hoping that swift advance would create surprise and preempt destruction. Various small units of 30 AU were landed in Normandy on the beaches on D-Day and immediately thereafter. Broad Force was the smallest of them, just 10 commandos and an officer, Major Niven Brodie and Lieutenant Bond. They had stepped ashore from their landing craft an hour after dawn at Jig Sector on Gold Beach and been driven inland in an army lorry towards the country town of Sainte-Sabine, close to the Chateau Malflacon, SS headquarters of that region of Normandy. They left their lorry with a forward unit of Canadian infantry and advanced on foot down the deep, narrow lanes of the Normandy Bocage into the fastness of the countryside. Bond combed his hair, smoothing back the forelock that kept falling forward out of position, as if it had a life of its own. Maybe he should change his hairstyle, he wondered. Idly, like that television presenter fellow, what was his name, and comb his hair forward in a short fringe, not bother with a parting at all in the contemporary fashion. No, he thought, pas mon style. He swallowed again. His throat was sore. He left his room, locking the door behind him, and wandered down the corridor, heading for the lift. He pressed the button to summon it, thinking, yes, scrambled eggs and bacon, many cups of coffee, a cigarette, that would set him on his feet again. The lift doors opened. Good morning, a woman's voice said from inside. Morning, Bond replied automatically as he stepped into the lift. He recognized the unforgettable scent immediately, the vanilla and iris of Guerlain's Shalimar, unforgettable because it was the perfume his mother used to wear. It was like opening a door to his childhood, so much of his past crowding in on him today, Bond thought, looking over to meet the eyes of the woman leaning in the corner. She smiled at him quizzically, an eyebrow raised. Happy birthday, she asked. How do you know it's my birthday? Bond just managed to keep the surprise from his voice, he thought. Just a good guess, she said. I could tell you were celebrating something last night. So was I. You sense these things. We celebrate celebrating. Bond touched the knot of his tie and cleared his throat, recalling the woman had been sitting in the dining room last night a few tables away from him. Yes, Bond said somewhat ruefully, it is indeed my birthday. He was buying a few seconds' time, his mind beginning to work. He was definitely off colour this morning. The lift hummed down to the lobby. So what were you celebrating? He asked. He remembered now. They had both been drinking champagne and had simultaneously raised their glasses across the room to each other. The fourth anniversary of my divorce, she said dryly. It's a tradition I keep. I treat myself to cocktails, dinner, vintage champagne, a night in a suite in the Dorchester, and then I send him the bill. She was a tall, rangy woman in her mid-30s, Bond estimated, with a strong, handsome face and thick, honey-blonde hair brushed back from her forehead and falling in an outward curve to her shoulders, blue eyes. Scandinavian? She was wearing a jersey all-in-one navy catsuit with an ostentatious gold zip that ran from just above her groin to her neck. The tightness of the close-fitting material revealed the full swell of her breasts. Bond allowed the nature of his carnal appraisal to register in his eyes for a split second and saw her own eyes flash back. Message received. The lift door slid open with a muffled ping at the ground floor. Enjoy the rest of your day, she said with a quick smile, and strode out into the wide lobby. And, of course, they get to know each other extremely well. Extremely well indeed.
Thanks very much. Fleming does do things sometimes to bring back bits of Bond's remoter past in the novels. But why did you decide to do that? You've got two sort of funny things going on at the same time. Were you doing a kind of roots of the psychology?
Well, I was in a way, and I wanted to get away from the films, because everybody sees Bond through the filter of the movies, which is a mistake, I think, because the Bond of the novels, the literary Bond, is a far more interesting and complex character. When I got the job, as it were, I decided I would reread Fleming's 12 novels and 8 short stories in chronological order, with pen in hand, analytically, forensically, to just revisit Bond, because I'd read the books as a young teenager, and I found out masses of things that I'd forgotten or had never realized or never known. There are about 5 references in Fleming's novels to Bond's combat experience in World War II, and they're literally just a line or two. In Dr. No, for example, there's a line, Bond is being machine-gunned by Dr. No's thugs, and he says something like, the last time he heard this noise was the rattle of German machine guns in the Ardennes. So you think, Ardennes Forest, 1944, Battle of the Bulge, what was James Bond doing there then? And then the references to him being in Berlin in 1945. So Fleming had dropped these little clues about a World War II experience, and I thought, well, the door is slightly open. I'm going to charge through it and invent a World War II backstory for Bond, authorized by Fleming. It just seemed to me to be a good way of opening the book, which is set in 1969. Bond is celebrating his 45th birthday, But he's a veteran of World War II, and it just takes you back. Mm. And you realize that, you know, a 45-year-old man in 1969 probably had a World War II experience, and just places him in his context. And, of course, he's in the Dorchester, and he's going down to have breakfast, and there's a beautiful woman in the lift, so there's all the other boxes.
And he's enjoying his shower. That's quite a big thing. Well, you know, he likes showers.
Yes, this is odd. There's four really enjoyable showers. To have a shower in 1950, which is when the Bond novels was written, was exotic. And this is the thing about Fleming's Bond. Again, you have to remember that most of the novels were published in the 1950s, and Casino Royale, 1953, I think there was still food rationing in Britain in 1953. So to read Casino Royale and to read about a man ordering caviar and a small chilled carafe of vodka must have seemed, you know, out of this world, if not completely unbelievable. So you have to kind of address it, I think. But also, he's troubled. And Fleming's Bond, as opposed to the movie Bond, has a real dark side and is a melancholic to a certain extent, makes big mistakes, is a troubled soul. And so I wanted very much to recreate that aspect of the personality and not just make him a blunt instrument, as he's sometimes described.
Because it is implicitly his first encounter with sort of fatal violence, and he's actually physically sick, isn't he? Were you consciously thinking of a, if not quite a mission to humanise Bond, at least to show that the kind of the endlessly resilient and adaptable dispatcher of villains?
You see, that's the movie Bond. Yes. Again, this is one of the other revelations of rereading the novels, is that, you know, Bond often cries. You know, tears flow. He will weep, and when he sees something really unpleasant, like a mangled corpse, you'll spontaneously vomit. Well, you haven't seen Daniel Craig vomit on screen for a while. But again, everything that seems slightly unusual about Bond in Solo is actually sourced in Fleming. I remember saying to the Fleming family when we had this sort of initial interview, and they said, what sort of Bond are you thinking of? And I said, well, I'm really interested in the real man, such as he is, and I want it to be a realistic novel. I didn't want it to be fantastical, and I didn't want him to be a cartoon character. And it's all there in Fleming's books. You know, it's quite astonishing. It's a rich seam to mine.
Of course, one of the Fleming formulae is about travel and locations, and you take Bond to somewhere, well, actually, probably you sort of know better than he does, in a way, or that's what it feels like. You take him to Africa, to an invented state.
Yes, an invented state that bears an uncanny resemblance to Nigeria. at the end of the 1960s, when the Nigerian Civil War was going on. Yes, it was part of this self-imposed mission statement that I'd given, that I wanted Bond to be, he's 45 years old, he's not an old man, but he's an experienced, mature man. And I wanted him to have a real mission that wasn't anything to do with some organization trying to rule the world or, you know, mountains filled with atom bombs and things like that. And so he goes to this nasty little African civil war. And I was living in Nigeria during that war, and I remember it vividly, and it had a profound effect on me. And I thought, Bond has never really gone to Africa in any of the Fleming novels. It was all this idea to make it real and not make it silly or gimmicky or fantastical in some way.
You do seem to delight in sticking to some of the convention. So the villain, for instance, is a really satisfyingly terrible, horrible, twisted, physically twisted, as they often are in Fleming's novel, villain.
Yes, there are certain Bond tropes and boxes you have to tick, and I think you'd be silly to take on the job if you weren't going to do it. I mean, not just the villain or the love affairs he has. There's a tremendous amount about food and drink in the Bond novels. And, you know, there's got to be an encounter with M and an encounter with Moneypenny. Part of the fun, and the serious fun, is actually trying to imagine what M would have been like. Yeah. You know, and I know a lot about Ian Fleming, and I know who he modelled M on. And so I was able to draw on that biographical knowledge I had. But similarly, you know, Bond is a massive boozer. So there's a huge amount of drinking in this novel, and entirely authentic. Yeah. Fleming was a massive boozer as well. And so these elements, which we think of as classic Bond, are actually, when you look at them more closely, quite intriguing. You know, Fleming, in some ways, was way ahead of his time in that he was very interested in lifestyle.
Yes.
And, you know, he cared about the cotton his shirt was woven out of and what brand of coffee he was drinking at breakfast. This is a commonplace today, but in the 50s, it must have seemed, you know, fantasy. And so Bond, who Fleming gave a lot of his traits and tastes to, has to deliver on this level as well. And you realize it's that era, that generation of Englishmen, or particularly of his class, where if you felt a bit, you know, rough in the morning, you took a couple of Benzedrine, and if you couldn't get to sleep at night, you had a big glass of chloral, and that knocked you out. And of course you paid a price. Fleming was 56 when he died, and in a terrible state. It's interesting now, through our perspective and through our to look at particularly English writers. We were talking about this earlier. English writers of that generation, not to mention American writers of that generation, who, you know, really did seem to have a kind of death wish, it seems to me. I think Fleming had one. I think Evelyn Waugh had one. Another writer, Henry Green, much forgotten. Cyril Connolly probably didn't have one, but couldn't restrain his appetites. They all went to relatively early graves.
In a way, that's what Fleming did with Bond, isn't it? He made out of that a kind of psychology and a story for him. Yeah, he says, "J'aime les sensations fortes."
Fleming was of that English moneyed upper class. You know, he was skiing in Kitzbühel in the 30s and holidaying in the winter in the Caribbean. He wasn't a particularly rich man, but he had a trust fund and was able to have his own cigarettes handmade at 2,000 at a time to his own blend. You know, that sort of thing, which seems, you know, the lot of Russian plutocrats today. He was only really happy, I believe, in the war when he worked for Naval Intelligence, where he had a uniform and a job, and his job was exciting. And I think his you know, misanthropy and his Tidium Vitae, which arrived in the midst of his huge success with Bond, was to do with the fact that he wasn't enjoying getting up in the morning anymore. And so he was quite in a hurry to die.
But I wondered if you got a sense of other sort of less, as it were, sociological reasons for the extraordinary appeal then and continuing appeal of the Bond novels.
I think the fact is that Bond is super competent, but also very human. I think that's very important. And he makes awful mistakes. He's not a superhero. So there's a sense in which he's a living, breathing spy, not some cartoon character. But my feeling is that it goes back to the world of Bond, because actually when you rereading the novels, you know, they are uneven. You can see Fleming's interest flagging. You can see his own boredom setting in. And there's one novel, The Spy Who Loved Me, which is a complete mind-boggling aberration. You wonder how he sat down and wrote it, let alone how his publishers let him publish it. But the analysis of the novels one by one, in a way, is not the point. It's the character and his world. And I feel that it's, you know, Fleming was a man of this particular class, and this class still exists in this country, and their world and their values still exists, which sounds odd, but it's true. And what Fleming did in writing those Bond novels was put Bond in that world that he knew and lift a lid on it. So you were given access to this very privileged club. You were a member of it while you read the Bond novel, and then the door slammed in your face when you finished it. And I think that's what makes them still interesting and endlessly fascinating for somebody like you and me, that you can read the Bond novels and whatever the silly plot or the ridiculous coincidences or dialogue that Barbara Cartland would be ashamed of, the textures and the details of Bond's world are absolutely fascinating, because Fleming knew completely what he was talking about. Bond is a sensualist, yes, in the way that, or a hedonist, even the way that Fleming was, and he cares about, you know, what he's wearing. And Bond didn't like women who wore nail varnish. Yeah. You know, why not? Fleming did like, you know, this is somebody who pays great attention to the textures and detail, yeah, of their everyday life, and it's untypical of a spy, yeah, I would suggest. But it somehow makes the myth all the more, yeah, enticing. How many spies, you know, yeah, can tell the difference between organza and, yes, you know, shot silk?
There's a bit of some Henry Tilney in Northanger Abbey about, yes, him, too. It's all muslin.
It's very, very, yeah, strange, yeah, how, yeah, these facts about him, which when I reread the novel, I became completely aware of, are part and parcel of the fictional character. But they make him more vivid and more real.
There's slight intimations, aren't there, in your book, that he's a man slightly out of his time, although perhaps not unappreciative of the changing times. He sits on the King's Road and sort of looks at the young,
yes,
in their sort of revealing clothes, and it does so as a man from another age, doesn't he? He goes to see Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, yes, at the cinema.
Leaves early.
Yes.
yes, because, you know, this is another thing. You know, Bond lives in Chelsea, and you think Chelsea in 1953 was a really unusual place for an author to plonk his leading British spy down, because it was a kind of bohemian, quite working class area with pockets of wealth. But Fleming's mother lived in Chelsea. That's why I think he knew about it. Well, I happen to live in Chelsea. It was very odd to think of Bond wandering up the King's Road in 1969 and going for a cappuccino in the Cafe Picasso, which, you know, conceivably in a parallel universe, he might have done. But of course, he's a World War II veteran. And I think of my father and his many brothers, who were all World War II veterans, and I can imagine them in 1969 in Chelsea and enjoying bits of it and recoiling from other bits of it. But it was, again, it's part of the thought experiment that you have to undergo to write a novel like this, or indeed to write any novel that's set in the past, even the relatively immediate past. You have to kind of reimagine it and make it real. And so the fact that Bond lived in Wellington Square and his manor was the King's Road seemed to me worth exploiting.
When you were doing it, did you feel, even if you weren't trying to parody him at all, did you feel sort of a principle of, I don't know, restraint or something, that you had to not write it in ways that you might have liked to?
No, I didn't, actually. I think one of the reasons I felt quite comfortable about accepting the job was that I'd written two spy novels myself, and so I understood the genre, and I understood what the demands of the genre were in terms of pacing and suspense and narrative twists and turns. I've written a lot about spies and spying, real ones and fictional ones. I've written a lot about John le Carré and Kim Philby, Cambridge spies and so on. So I was very steeped in that world. So there's no sense in which I had to kind of re-educate myself and how do you write a spy novel. But also the other thing, that the appeal of being asked to do this is that there is no prescription, there is no remit. So I actually wrote it entirely in my own voice, as I would write my own novel, but within the conventions of the genre of a spy novel, which I had done on two occasions before.
Okay, well, we've got a couple of microphones, I think. We've got lots of questions. There's a gentleman there.
I used to work in West Africa as a journalist, and I'm interested in how you created a suave English character in conditions that are physically quite difficult, very hot, very sweaty, very humid. How do you go about making a sophisticated European in those conditions?
I certainly wasn't a sophisticated European, but I remember them vividly. Bond has to get down and dirty in this African country I invent, that he doesn't have many changes of clothing, and he doesn't have the opportunity to have powerful hot showers several times a day. So it was a simple matter of imagining what it would be like for him in these various situations I put him in. I mean, he's in a hotel, In the capital city, but then he's—I don't want to spoiler alert—and then but then he's in far more extreme circumstances, and so it's just—it's like anything you do in a novel which you haven't experienced yourself, you have to try and imagine what it's like. I mean, I've never killed anybody, you'll be glad to hear, but I've killed many people in my novels. Whatever situation Bond finds himself in West Africa, I've been stopped at roadblocks in West Africa. I've had drunken soldiers wave their AK-47s at me.
I guess Fleming and all the subsequent authors have added their own patina and depth to the character. I was interested to know what insight or perspective you uniquely gave him you're most proud of.
I don't think I'd ever realised this before, but you know, Bond isn't English. He's half Scottish and half Swiss. And I thought that is really interesting. And as I read the Fleming novels, there's constant, again, throwaway reference to his Scottishness. As a Scot myself, I sort of reclaimed him for the homeland. And there's a line in You Only Live Twice where Bond says to M, "I'm just a Scottish peasant." Which, again, you will never hear uttered in the movies, but I put it in the solo, I translated it into French. I just thought that was very... And there's another line where Bond says, in the Fleming novel, he says, he always felt something of an alien in England. So that was an insight which I thought was quite intriguing to enhance. I wouldn't have dared do it without Fleming's sort of authority. He isn't a toff. You know, an English toff. It's an interesting spin on the man. And, you know, Fleming didn't do this in any kind of thought-through way. There's sort of a process of accretion that we arrive at the Bond, particularly the Bond of You Only Live Twice, where the obituary is written. But that I think, was the Bond that he saw. And all these little clues are dropped. He was orphaned at the age of 11, which I think is quite interesting, which may explain his melancholia, his dark side. These were particular things that I thought were fascinating.
What I really wanted to ask you was what you were thinking when you were asked to take this on. You know, did you think about it as a bit of a risk, or did you think about it for one nanosecond before you said yes? Or have you always had a Bond novel in there?
No, I mean, it's not something you can audition for or volunteer for. You can't let it be known that you'd like to write a James Bond novel. So it comes completely out of the blue. It's a funny state of circumstances. I just finished my last novel, Waiting for Sunrise, and I do work to commission a lot. I write a lot of films and I write a lot of television drama, and I'm often approached with ideas saying, would you write us, for example, a six-part miniseries about Hitler's rise to power? I've just written a three-hour life of Lawrence of Arabia, very strange man. And so, in a way, the idea of taking this, you know, iconic, terrible word, but I have to use it, figure from literature and reimagining him and inventing a story for him wasn't that unusual to me. Maybe to other novelists it might have seemed strange or daunting, but because it's something I've been doing for years and years, adapting other novels, you know, I've adapted Evelyn Waugh novels, classics of English literature, so I've not been bothered about writing a four-hour version of Evelyn Waugh's Sword of Honor trilogy. So in a way, to say, would you write a James Bond novel, didn't seem to me something strange or, you know, overly challenging. It seems part of the work that I do anyway. And because I'd written two spy novels, Restless and Waiting for Sunrise, I was kind of in complete spy mode. And I now see that Solo is the third panel of my spy triptych. If I had been told that you have to write to a specific formula or it has to fit this specific template, I wouldn't have done it. But the wonderful thing about being offered the job is you are given this virtual free hand. You just have to respect the tradition, and you wouldn't take it on if you weren't going to respect the tradition. But otherwise, it's up to you.
I'm often shocked about some of his observations or how old-fashioned some of his views were. Do you feel that this restricted you when you were building this Bond novel and putting together his character for this novel? And did you always like Bond? Was there a time when you actually read the book? I know you said some of the plots were risible or weak. Did you ever look at the character or the person and think, I don't actually know if I like Bond today?
Well, good point. I mean, I read Bond as a youngish teenager. I read them in my teens. I'd seen some of the films, and there's this other curious thing about my life is that three of the Bond actors have been in films I've written. So I know three of the actors. So I have this curious familiarity with Bond, but it's the movie Bond. To be honest, I'm not a great fan of the Bond movies. It's not really my cup of tea. But rereading the novels was, again, fascinating because Fleming's attitudes in the 50s are unacceptable today. There's no doubt about it. His attitudes to foreigners are hilariously funny. He's incredibly rude about Italians, but in the way that sort of upper-class Englishman would have been amongst his friends at the time. He's homophobic, he's racist, he's sexist, he's fascist, you name it. Every ist can be found in the Bond novels. But I think it's unreflected. If you'd said to Ian Fleming, you're a racist homophobe, he'd have been outraged. And yet you could point to chapter and verse in his novels. But it was that sort of unreflecting world of his class that permeates the novels. One of the things that I said to myself, in a way, was that by moving on to 1969, Bond is no fool. Bond is well-read. This is another fact that's quite interesting when you reread the novels. He left school at 17, but he's an autodidact. He can quote Milton. Mm. He quotes Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Yeah,
quotes Paddy Lee Fermor, Lafcadio. You know, so there's a sense which Bond is not a fool. And so I said to myself, well, 45-year-old, experienced, intelligent man living in Chelsea in 1969, the world has changed. And he would have seen that, and he would have changed to a degree, I imagine. So I didn't feel obliged to kind of whitewash the Fleming Bond in a way and make him more politically correct. I just put him down in the world of 1969, and I think anybody of his age and his sentience would realise that the attitudes he'd had a decade or so earlier weren't going to work anymore. But it is extraordinary to read the earlier novels now, and you get an insight into, it's like T.S. Eliot's anti-Semitism, and it's sort of unreflecting. It's all there in Fleming, you know, women drivers, you know, it's absurd, and it's offensive, but that was the attitude of the class he came from, and he wouldn't have thought for a moment anybody would have taken offence.
And I'm sure you'd want me to thank him very much for coming and talking to us this evening.
Thank you very much.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.